Welcome to Conversations on Doing Good, when we talk with leading Asia-based philanthropists and business leaders on their views, strategies, and objectives in investing in the social sector. I am Ruth Shapiro, founder and chief executive of CAPS, the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society. With each conversation, we seek to understand what motivates a philanthropist, why he or she picks the types of projects they do, and what they see as the role of private money in addressing social challenges. In this special episode, I had the wonderful opportunity to talk with Nadiem Makarim, Minister of Education in Indonesia. This conversation was part of the Edom Prize Foundation's Asia-Pacific Conference, carried out in collaboration with our center. The conference focused on the impact of COVID-19 on education. I really want to thank you so much for coming on to join us for our conference this afternoon. And as you know, you and I will engage in a conversation. And I have a number of questions for you. And you are, of course, famous around the world, particularly in Indonesia. But let me just ask you, you were a successful businessman. You did create the first Indonesian startup that has become a decacorn, which was a word that I had to look it up. So congratulations for that. But then you left to become the Minister of Education. Why did you do that?
There are a few reasons why I did that. I think to know why I decided to become Minister of Education, I think it's important to recap why I decided to build Gojek. And my primary drive and what really moves me is creating solutions on a mass scale for the problems that we face day to day. So that's always really been the driving force behind my entrepreneurship and everything that I do. So for me, the opportunity to be able to do, to have impact on a scale like the education system in Indonesia was as terrifying as that was. And it was terrifying for me to accept that responsibility. But I felt that my fear should come second to the potential impact that me and my team could have to 60 million students in Indonesia. So when I think about it very rationally, part of what I was doing in the technology space was to level the playing field, to make sure that people, no matter where their social status, their economic status, they could afford a good living. And we're able to create one of the largest employment sectors in Indonesia, new jobs, doing that with technology. But when I really think about what is the ultimate leveler of the playing field in a country as big as Indonesia, it has to be education. If you look at every single major problem that we are about to face, inequity, climate change, tribalism, all types of economic, environmental, and health issues that we face in the future, at the end of the day, humans are going to have to solve that problem. And no matter which way you look at it, it is much harder to change the adults in any system. I mean, it's a little bit for you and me, Ruth, you know, changing our mindset and enabling us to see things from different perspectives is harder than the next generation. It's much easier for younger people to actually go ahead and solve these complex, hyper-complex problems of the future. So I thought that whatever the problems of Indonesia's future, the solution lies in its future, which is the future generation. And that's why I couldn't say no. What I didn't predict was the pandemic.
Well, that's what we want to talk about. But before we get there, I mean, yes, the pandemic does throw a monkey wrench of sorts into the best laid plans. Let me just stay on you for a while for one more question. And that is, you had a very good education. You went to Brown and then you went to Harvard Business School in the United States. So was there a pivotal moment or a key educational experience that you had in your life that really helps us to understand your thinking about education?
Well, I think there were many, but if I had to pick one or two, I think that were quite transformative for me. The first was in middle school. I had an incredible English teacher who for the first time gave me the understanding that reading was a way to unlock my own imagination. And that teacher was so passionate about whatever she taught me, and I was like 12 at this time, that I just truly felt that, you know, it was at that time that I realized that reading and writing were an extension of my imagination in this world. And I thought that was a beautiful kind of moment in my own realization about creativity and the link between that and reading. So that's when I fell in love with books, really. I think my next seminal moment was, you know, when people ask me, what is the single most important subject that you took in your educational system? I would have to say, and this surprises everyone all the time, IB Higher Theater Arts. Oh. I did the IB program. And the reason, it wasn't just because I had a fantastic teacher for IB Higher Theater Arts, but I think that theater arts for me represented the pinnacle of what a curriculum should be like, because it involved collaboration, teamwork, it involved real world practice, it involved putting yourself out there, and it involved taking huge amounts of risk. I thought was the building blocks for a lot of the confidence and a lot of the team building capabilities that I have today. So I thought those were the two parts. And then I have to say, when I was in business school, my final seminal moment was watching my friends start businesses. Watching my friends start businesses was that pivotal moment in my head where I began to think, wait a minute, they're doing it. I can do this too. I think that role modeling for my peers was another transformational part of my education, where I felt compelled, you know, I'm ready to start something. And that's where I started Gojek. It was during those 2 years of business school. So I would say those are some of my most seminal
moments. And those really speak to what I've learned are the operating principles and pedagogical thinking that's behind what you're trying to do with the education system in Indonesia. And I want to talk about that, but we really do have to deal with the elephant in the room, which is COVID-19. You have some very ambitious and extraordinary plans to reform the education system. How bad is COVID-19 in your world? And maybe you could just help us to understand how you're thinking about this.
Right. So COVID's bad for education, mm-hmm. no matter which way you see it. Doesn't matter if you're in the first world, you know, emerging economies, it's bad. It's bad for everyone. The world will experience a significant drop in learning outcomes as a result of COVID-19, the severity of which we will never know until we do research over time. That's kind of the difficult part with education. You know, quantifying the impact is extremely difficult because it's a time series. You need to see over time how to see what the effect will be. So yes, there's no point in sugarcoating it. It's bad. I'm pretty sure PISA scores will reflect that globally. I hope it's not as bad as many people think. And I'm certainly maintaining my optimism, but it's bad. And it's bad particularly for certain segments of children. I believe that there's two dimensions and perspectives that it affects disproportionately. The first is the dimension of infrastructure access and economic status. The have-nots that don't have access to internet, that don't have the means to pay for data, et cetera, will suffer more during this time. And so I think that's the first gap of inequity that it will create. The second part is it will disproportionately affect younger children, I think. Much more so. When we're talking about early childhood education, when we're talking about elementary school, the need to have that face-to-face emotional and empathetic connection with teachers and with fellow students is going to have disproportionate impact on those younger kids. Older kids are maybe more able to do online learning, even though it, you know, for many, it bores them and there's a huge amount of challenges, but it will affect them less because it is also those years that as you get older, the transformative effect of education becomes less than the younger years. So those are, I think, the two dimensions. And I think Indonesia is in a very acute position whereby we're the largest archipelago in the world, right, with massive infrastructural challenges. And so we have to take a very, very balanced approach between the health implications and risks and the educational risk. Everybody in the world is all talking about the health risks of COVID. We have a health crisis. We have an economic crisis. I'm not hearing enough people talking about the educational crisis that is happening. That frustrates me because those are permanent effects that can be generational.
I agree with you. People are focused on health and on the economics, and yet education is probably the most impacted sector over the longer term, and the implications of that are very serious. But Indonesia is the biggest archipelago in the world, and distance learning was not completely unheard of there. And I know that part of your agenda is the introduction of technology and hybrid tools and solutions, which were necessary before COVID, obviously more necessary now. Maybe can you talk us through a little bit how you view hybrid solutions and the use of technology in concert and in hand with terrific teachers and that human-human dimension?
Sure. First, if you don't mind, I'd like to point out that, you know, in the educational space, and often people who are outside of the educational space, they tend to equate technology in education with distance learning. Mm-hmm. They do have an overlap, but they are not the same thing. So I always have to reclarify to people that technology is just an enabler to do whatever it is that you're trying to do in a better, faster, more efficient, or more effective way. That's what, by definition, that's what technology is. Distance learning is what we are all forced to do now because of the health crisis. The way I see technology, or the way our ministry sees technology in the education industry, has to be first and foremost technology that enables the humans in the system to be able to do their job better, to improve educational outcomes. Don't forget, everything that we do has to, at the end of the day, improve educational outcomes for the students. And so technology, in our eyes, is this enabler. It's an enhancer of the capability of teachers, capability of parents, and of course, the capability of the students to actually accelerate and improve those learning outcomes. The first use of technology in education is not actually distance learning. The most important use for technology in education is reinforcing the teacher, giving the teacher superpowers with which to teaching at the right level. This is one of the hardest things to do in education, in knowing how do you segmentize or even personalize the educational material that you're teaching to suit the competency level of your class or of individual students in your class. The only way to do that is through technology, is by having these tools that teachers can use to do rapid diagnostics on students, and then be able to choose and match which level of the curriculum is appropriate for that student or for their class. So what's happening now, not just in Indonesia, around the world, is there's this massive uniformity of curriculum, especially in the developing world, where everyone is being taught at the same level, because that's what a fourth grader should be taught, the book, the level, everywhere around the country. But what the world doesn't behave that way. What a fourth grader, a level of literacy of fourth grade in the islands of Maluku and the city of Jogja and the city of Jakarta, these are different, very, very different levels. And they're not always, because you've got literacy levels and numeracy levels that have huge variances. And learning, like video games, follows a very simple principle, which is too easy, you get bored. Too difficult, you lose hope and you disengage. And so this concept of using technology to guide the teacher to teach at the right level is, I think, one of the most powerful and transformative parts of how to make a teacher more effective. The second part, how I see technology really helping, is don't forget that schools are institutions. They are institutions with bureaucracy, with regulations, with a huge amount of financial regulatory overhead that needs to happen because they're administered by the state. You would not believe the amount of time that teachers and principals spend managing the administrative requirements of the bureaucracy versus actually improving learning outcomes in their school. Technology tools that automate these administrative and can take a huge amount of burden from teachers and principals away from that task, and therefore they can dedicate it to the students, will transform the amount of time that teachers and principals spend on focusing on improvements. So that's another example of how technology can be a huge help.
Those are really helpful.
And finally, I would say, in the transparency of budget management, being able to digitize spend of national educational budgets and remove the element of discretionary spending using cash, et cetera, that can create all types of bad practices, is also another way of making sure that the taxpayers' money is really getting to where it needs to go. And technology can play a pivotal role in ensuring that budget. So all of these parts are things that enhance the teaching capability of humans instead of replacing humans. And I believe that's the highest potential for technology in education. Those are just some few examples. I have many, many more.
I appreciate those examples very much. You have a philosophy, I suppose it's a philosophy, my Bahasa is not fluent, so Merdeka Belajar. Yes. I wonder if you can help us understand what that is and why you think it's important.
So Merdeka Belajar, there's no perfect translation for the word, but it kind of means emancipated learning. Okay? That's what Merdeka means, to emancipate. Okay. And the philosophy actually came from one of the founding fathers of education in Indonesia, Ki Hajar Dewantoro. So we're kind of returning back to our roots in that the philosophy, the underlying philosophy, is that education is a way of freeing the mind, and therefore freeing the potential of the individual to do and pursue what they want to pursue in life for a positive impact around them. That philosophy was resonated very powerfully with me and with my team here, because it also points out at all the things that I think we've been getting not so right. So it's time for us to hyper-innovate and to emancipate education. And here are some of the principles of emancipation of education. First of all, the curriculum itself. To give the freedom to make the curriculum not a set fixed course meal, but to make it instead into a menu that teachers can go and shop from different modules of that menu and then recreate something that meets the appetite, which is the passion and the level of competency, the appropriate level of competency for their students. So this is connected to the teach at the right level. That's a type of freedom. The freedom for teachers to actually decide which parts of the curriculum is actually appropriate for them. The freedom to also create curriculum and take local insights and local knowledge from each of their respective districts and put that as part of the curriculum and not just have this sense of rigid uniformity, because we've tried standardization. That didn't work. A lot of countries have tried this, and standardization did not create the results that we wanted to. So I think we should embrace some level of diversity in the curriculum that will be able to bring back the relevancy and the passion in kids again. So that's one of the freedoms. The second part is the freedom for the school itself to determine which direction that they would like to go in terms of their budget and which areas of focus. Do they want to be more slanted towards the arts? Do they want to be more slanted towards sports? Do they want to be more slanted towards numeracy and literacy? And having that discretion and autonomy is something that we firmly believe in schools, no matter the respective level of competency. This is always the argument against this. But always the argument is Nadim, but without required competencies, you know, how do you expect teachers to recompose or restructure curriculum, create their own lesson plans when they don't know how to do that? Well, my response back to that feedback, to that criticism, is always simple. If a teacher is not reinterpreting the curriculum themselves, how are they able to teach it? The very process of teaching is a process of interpreting something, information, and then reformulating it for the students. So there is no such thing as students learning without teachers actually taking active learning and reinterpretation of a curriculum. The science
behind
learning.
That is a little bit radical, right? Because the teacher has to feel that sense of agency that they can do that. So it's a chicken and egg because they're a product of their own environment and their own circumstances. So where's the leverage there? Where's the pivot? Where's the point where you can best change that cycle and give sense of agency both to the schools, to the teacher, and to the student?
One, well, you have to go from the most important individual in the school first, the first person of the unit of change. By the way, the unit of change in an educational system is a school. Mm-hmm. It is not a district. It is not the ministry. Mm-hmm. It is not even the neighborhood. It is the school. So the most important change agent in that school is always the most powerful person in that school. And that is the principal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it's, you can have a lot of teachers that want to change, want to try new things in a school, but without a supportive principal, it's very, very difficult. So one of our key priorities in programs is to reimagine the criteria and the job description of what does a principal do, and change them from being an administrator of a national educational system and policy to the pedagogical leader of the school. In simpler terms, to become the chief mentor of teachers in the schools. Right. You look at the best educational institutions in the world. It doesn't matter if it's early childhood, elementary, even the best, name all your best charter schools in the US, for example. Mm-hmm. The one thing you will always see is that the principal is the one doing the walk arounds. The right. principal is the one entering the classroom, observing, bringing in young teachers, saying, hey, what is this teacher doing here? So that role as chief coach needs to be reestablished firmly as the principal role. And that principal needs to have the freedom to command their little kingdom. So the autonomy that we give them, the budgetary discretion that we give them, and the flex on how they would like to prioritize which subjects, hours, teaching, how much co-curricular, how much in-class teaching, that's what we're trying to give, irrespectively of the level of competency. I want to say this every single time, because I think this is a logical fallacy in education, that you're right, it's a chicken or egg. Without first giving them the agency, you will never know what their true level of competency is to mm-hmm. begin with. So we have to give that trust first to see. And in educational systems in Indonesia, where the basis based on PISA scores, et cetera, is already quite low, we have a lot of catch up to play, the risk is far lower to right. try a method that we haven't tried before. So right. that's one thing. Now, of course, then what happens is you need to create proper mentorship and training structures. Without that, this will fail as well. And the biggest, I think, fallacy in a lot of educational systems is this belief that training teachers is a factor of getting them together, putting a PowerPoint together, a great seminar, and then teaching them some amazing philosophical insights and techniques, and then sending them out back to the world. Now, for every other craft, whether it's a musician, athlete, you name it, every other craft, training happens through peer-to-peer mentorship and coaching. And it can only happen, you cannot learn how to play the piano without the piano.
Right.
You cannot learn how to become a better teacher without a classroom.
Well, and it also is an iterative process. It's not a one-off, right? So you have to be willing to be patient with the results.
Correct. Yeah, these don't happen overnight.
Right.
But the concept, just the very paradigm that we're trying to shift now, is that you can't teach how to teach without being in a classroom. That is the essence. Being mentored by another teacher who's better than you or is more experienced than you within a classroom of real students is the best way to learn. So what we're focusing on is building what we call Sekolah Penggeraks, which are training schools, basically, but with real students. And they cannot be rich students. They have to be poor students in areas that are difficult, right? They have to be students that have already some systemic disadvantage. And to be able to have good teachers teaching disadvantaged students and have other teachers come and observe and be mentored. And so this is a new paradigm that we're trying to push. And of course, you're absolutely correct. This is not going to happen overnight. In fact, I've said this multiple times. It is impossible to transform an educational system in 5 years. You know, it's impossible to do in 10 years. Usually the time frame to do something meaningful is about 20 years. But what can you achieve in 5 years? What you can achieve, hopefully, and this is our mission, is to not to transform the entire system, but to get to the tipping point. To get to that point of irreversible change where you have significant enough number of change agents installed in all these levels of the system that it's virtually impossible to reverse. And so that's the hope. The philosophy is islands of change.
Wonderful hope, but I mean, not to rain on the parade, but that's an ambitious 5-year plan without COVID. Do you feel like you're still making progress toward that even despite these very difficult circumstances?
I think the primary victim of COVID, I think, are the students themselves and their learning outcomes. But as a educational system reform agenda, COVID presents a few opportunities, actually.
Okay.
We've never before seen, I think, at least in my lifetime, we've never before seen the number of parents and teachers stumbling across learning how to use technological platforms. We've never seen this level of adoption, even though they struggle with it. Right. We've never seen before this kind of forced adoption of experimentation with technological platforms. This is something unprecedented, and it's exciting. It's exciting what the impact of this will be. The other part that is exciting is we've never before seen the number of parents finally realize what a curriculum is.
The engagement, yeah.
How difficult it is to actually teach your kid something that is not intuitively something you know. The role and importance of parents in teaching has never before been thrown into the forefront as it is now during
That's
COVID.
True.
And so that will have lasting effects that I do believe are going to be positive. The old notion of the school as a way to outsource education is being challenged significantly because of the COVID crisis. So that's another very, I think, potentially positive trend. And then you've got the inequity issue that COVID exacerbated really will push policies to accelerate.
Right.
So the agenda on digitalizing schools to level the playing field in areas that may not have access is now been accelerated. The redistribution of great teachers, technological tools to describe all the things that I mentioned before to enhance the way schools operate are being accelerated and funding is getting secured and people are realizing the importance of it. So from a reform agenda, I feel like it could be net, net positive, especially when you're trying to do transformational change.
Well,
but
I love hearing
it doesn't
that.
Change the fact that the learning outcomes have suffered.
Right. No, I love hearing that. And actually, bringing the families into education has got to be a really important and silver lining of all of this. And that's happening globally. So that part is exciting. And we'll see over time, as you said, the impact of that.
You are listening to a special episode of Conversations on Doing Good, a podcast series put on by CAPS, the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society. In this episode, I am talking with Minister of Education from Indonesia, Nadiem Makarim.
One of the aspects of what you're trying to do, and we talked about emancipation and agency, but, you know, it's developing these soft skills is, from my understanding of your philosophy, just as important as math, reading, and arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can just address which ones you think are important. Those are the 21st century skills. And actually learning together as a family could be extremely reinforcing when it comes to thinking about those, that innovation, that creativity, that willing to think out of the box.
Yeah, so we've created this framework of which, you know, we didn't make it from scratch. It definitely has been inspired by 21st century learning, but we kind of a little bit simplified what is the profile of the student that we're trying to create? What are the characteristics that matter most? Because education, unlike other sectors, education by default must be future oriented.
Right.
right? Its value is only further realized in the future. So you always have to be looking to the future to create an effective educational system because of the lag that it happens. So this is why it's so complicated, right? how to measure success in education as well. So these most important profiles are, or competencies, if you will, are, the first is, of course, integrity and morality. Mm-hmm. The second is tolerance and diversity. I'm translating from the Indonesian version. This is more about a sense of nationalism and global citizenship, feeling that common sense of humanity, not just among Indonesia, but as humans as well. Very important sense. And it is a competency. That mindset is a competency. Mm-hmm. The third is teamwork, how to work in teams. There is no more individual sport, especially in the future.
That's right.
Everything is going to be a team sport. If you don't know how to work in teams, even individual sports are team sports. You ask any star athlete, mm-hmm. it's a team sport, right? Even if the sport is just for one person, you know, they're competing as a solo competitor. Mm-hmm. So teamwork. Fourth is creativity. Mm-hmm. The ability to look at problems in a different way and to produce. That ability to produce a body of work, a portfolio of work. And not just to learn, but to create. And then, of course, critical thinking, which are problem-solving skills. This is where the numeracy and literacy core foundational part of seeing a problem, being able to process that information, and being able to process information critically. And then the final one is, I believe the translation would be independence, but you could also see this as a growth mindset. So it's the intrinsic motivation to keep on wanting to get better. And this goes with the continuous learning for a lifetime, you know, learning as a process, as a journey throughout your whole life. So these are the six profiles. We call them the six profile Pelajar Pancasila. And we believe that these are going to be the most important values / competencies that we are trying to push through our curriculum, through our teacher training, teacher selection, and so on. And those, I think, are going to be the most important in the future.
And Pat Nadeem, I mean, those six are virtues that I think everyone hearing them would say, yes, those are important, those are great, that's a terrific list, I buy into that. And yet you've experienced some headwinds and pushback in terms of putting these mindset and these reforms into place. I don't want to drag you through the difficulties, but why do you think you've encountered this pushback, and what have you learned about, I suppose, the political process as a result of it?
Well, you know, being a leader in government, I think complex would be an understatement.
Right.
I came from the private sector, and coming into the public sector, you know, I was told that there would be huge amounts of complications and complexities and stakeholder management, et cetera. But, you know, you never really know until you're in it. And so
hope springs eternal.
But the thing is, you know, I've come to learn that resistance or pushback is a signal that you're actually changing something. And I think that I would be way more worried if there was no pushback at all. If you were a public leader, mm-hmm. and there was no pushback at all, I would significantly look back into what you're doing and whether you're actually transforming anything meaningful. So I think that history has shown that, you know, a healthy dose of resistance, but also the willingness to listen to the root causes of those resistance points is a very important part of any change management process. So that's how I've kind of recrafted it in my mind, that resistance is just a normal part of change, mm-hmm. because naturally humans have a natural tendency to want to keep, you know, the status quo. It's a very natural human habit. I recognize those habits in myself too. Mm-hmm. And I think every human does. And it is the burden of leadership to have to convince people that the biggest risk is not change, that the biggest risk is staying in place.
Is not right changing.
And that's kind of something that I have to learn every day and learn the political machinations you know, how to do that every day more and more effectively. I love learning that part, though. I mean,
that's
I feel
good.
Like once I'm done with these 5 years, I don't think anything will scare me anymore.
No, I don't think so. I think you will have climbed the highest peak. I think about your job vis-a-vis other ministers. And in some ways, Ministry of Education, I think, is the hardest because if you're Minister of Trade or Minister of Finance, it's a specialized skill set, and not everyone believes that they themselves are an expert in finance or commerce. But education, we're all experts, right? We all went through it, and we all have views, and most people have children. So you've got a very big peanut gallery of experts, which I think must, in some ways, make that resistance more interesting, but also bigger than any other ministry, I think.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. I don't hear that often, but the sympathy is well appreciated. You know, as ministers of education, not just me, but ministers of education everywhere in the world, I mean, we have to make impossible choices between worse and, you know, bad and worse decisions. Like, how do you even begin to make a decision about the health risks of opening a school versus an entire lost generation in a marginalized society not receiving any education at all? Like, how do you begin to make decisions like that? I mean, these are, I call them impossible decisions.
Well, they're literally life and death decisions.
Yes, that's what makes them impossible decisions, because, you know, how do you assign value to those kind of things? How do you decide on the relative importance of accelerating change because these kids need it now and we're facing an educational crisis, versus the sustainability of that change, mm-hmm. if there meets too much resistance? How hard do you push? At what point do you outspend your political capital to move the reforms that you know those kids badly need today? Where do you draw the compromises on allowing freedom, but also pushing schools to make those required changes? And this is hyper complicated by the fact that you've got multi-tier school ownership. Schools right. in Indonesia are owned by districts. High schools in Indonesia are owned by provincial governments. It's an explosion of complexity. And on top of that, and I think this is what the worst part of all, on top of that, you know, when you're dealing with trade or other, there are clear metrics of success. There are very, very clear metrics of success. And those metrics of success have shorter time lags. Whereas with education, you're dealing in 10-year cycles, whereby none of the impact can be measured during the time that the ministry is actually executing those programs. So you're kind of shooting in the dark.
Right.
A lot of the times. And you never get the satisfaction of actually seeing the fruition of your efforts until much, much later. And so, it's hugely challenging. I really like challenging tasks. I've always have. But I've never met a challenge of deeper complexity. Just, Ruth, asking someone, how do you measure success or performance in an educational system? You ask 10 different educational experts, they'll give you 10 completely different answers.
That's right.
That alone is a massive philosophical debate on how you measure the performance of a school and of an educational system.
And it's changing in real time because the issues and the challenges that young people have are different than in previous generations. So those success levels are changing. Are dynamic at the same time.
But there is one almost, I call it the golden rule.
Okay.
In education. And this is the part that out of all the different theories of impact, etc., this one is the irrefutable one. And the principle is simple, but how to achieve it is extremely difficult. But the principle is, if you put great people in the right position, anywhere in the system of education, learning outcomes will improve. Now, there's obviously definition. The key question there is, what is the definition of great people, right?
Right.
And great teachers, specifically in this, or great principals. But putting that aside, assuming that there is a way of identifying what great people, let's assume that's possible, giving them the power and authority to do what's best for the kids has never failed in the educational system. It always leads to positive results.
Absolutely.
So at the end of the day, this is a human transformation process. We should never forget that. At the end of the day, it's about how we can have great educational leaders in the schools that need the most with the freedom and resource to do their thing. That anywhere in the world, that has been the thread.
When I was preparing for this and I was talking to several members of your team, I was quite impressed with the caliber of the people who are around you. And a number of them, as you know, left industry, left finance, left advertising to come and work with you at the ministry. And I asked them, you know, why? And they said, well, we believe in Pak Nadiem. We are committed to Indonesia, we are committed to the future, but he's the guy who can really help realize the potential, which was wonderful, but there's only one of you. And what any country needs, including Indonesia, is teachers in those schools. The unit of change is the school. And, you know, what is it that you can do, that we can all do, to think about getting those people, those really terrific young people, to choose teaching as their profession? What do you think about that?
Well, that is an easier question to answer.
Okay.
Because we know what makes teaching attractive for talented people. We know this in the world. We learned this from OECD, from the World Bank, and all their research that they've done. Basically, talented people are attracted to the same things. They are attracted to high purpose jobs, of which teaching actually is the easiest one.
The highest.
Yeah, very. Number one is that. No. Number two, professional autonomy. What does that mean? Does the government, for example, lawyers, very high professional thing, does the government go and set how lawyers are taught, what leveling, how do they their careers get promoted, etc.? No. Lawyers themselves, they have guilds.
Right.
They have these own professional autonomy to determine who of them deserve to be promoted, etc. Like, so professional autonomy is a very important aspect of this. And third, of course, can't sacrifice a minimum economic need. After a certain point, money doesn't matter anymore. We've seen this happen all the time. Money can be destructive. In educational systems, if it's thrown as a performance incentive, like getting a high test score for kids, you get money. It can be really, really destructive. But you need to have a certain required level of welfare whereby those teachers are not worried about how they're going to fund their kid's school or right. If their kid gets sick, they can go. So there is a minimum level of welfare that is required. And then finally, what needs to happen is the growth and development. Talented people are always thirsty for growth. If they do not feel that their professional community or the government or whoever is hiring them are providing them with opportunities to learn and advance, it's not just the freedom, don't forget, it's not just the freedom and autonomy. It's also options, access to, am I learning a cutting edge new way of teaching multiplication? Do I get to learn from a master teacher from Jakarta that's super awesome at describing history? Those access points are what make the profession more exciting. And that's the only way to get the smartest people to look at teaching as an attractive way. There's no secret to how to do that. But doing it is very hard.
It's very hard, right.
On a mass scale. And it's expensive. It's expensive at a system of 3 million teachers, 60 million students. Like, those numbers, you know, for a lot of people, whenever I describe the system to, like, Singaporean educationalists, you know, those numbers just, they flabbergast.
I have an audience question, which I had to pick given that I run the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society. One question is, what's the role of philanthropy in education? We've been talking about the role of the state for the most part of this conversation. What is the role of philanthropy?
Oh, that's a very big question. And a very good one. I do believe that in the educational space, the role of philanthropy are to do things that the government are just not able to do. By showing the government, prototypes of what education can be. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think the role of philanthropy is to go, you know, I think Bill Gates said this a few times, where philanthropy has this critical role in stretching the imagination that then can be a shining light for governments, policymakers, and educators to see that, hey, it's possible. Because once you expand the realm of what is that a maker school can be just as effective in teaching computational logic as cookie cutter math.
Right.
Right. Teaching that actually extracurricular activities are way more effective at building collaborative skills than sitting in a classroom. You know, proving those kind of things that we know as, you know, pedagogical champions, we know them to be true, but proving that quantitatively, I think, is a huge opportunity for philanthropic organizations. The other things are proving things in the hardest areas.
Right.
Going to where
the last mile.
Yeah, the last mile, the most impossible areas that everyone says this is beyond help. We've got stunting problems. We've got economic problems. We've got malnutrition problems. There's no electricity and so on. And going there and kind of proving models of support that work so that to show the government with just a fraction of a cost, the government can have this much impact. That's powerful. And I think the role of philanthropy in those peripheries is very, very powerful. The problem with philanthropy in education versus others is that the role of the public sector, if I could do this outside of the government, if I think I could create meaningful change from the private sector only, I would have done it already.
Right.
The reason why I joined the public sector was I did the math and I looked at the sector and I looked at the relative resource and I'm just like, wow, the odds are so stacked against private sector or philanthropic sector to create on impact on a national scale. It has to be through the system that we do this. So making sure that philanthropic organizations are always attached to government, always attached and knocking at the door of government. Hey, look at this. Look at what we did. Put resource and money on this because it works. Here's the data. That version of, I think that's the way philanthropic organizations will have long-lasting impact. If they are strong enough and belligerent enough to constantly knock on the door of government and say, look at what we did here, you should be doing this.
So let me ask you the question that you probably always get asked, and you alluded to it earlier. You have 5 years left, plus or minus a couple of months.
Four years.
Okay. Is there one sentence where you can say, in the 4 years, I will feel great if I do what? What is it?
In 4 years' time, I will feel great if we are able to prove in 10,000 schools that improving learning outcomes can be achievable in an efficient, cost-efficient way if you focus on the human capacity. So that's what I want to set out to prove. Because if I can prove that in 10,000 schools, I haven't talked anything about higher education. That's a whole other day of topic that I can do that for later. But if I had to pick that in 10,000 schools is the tipping point. It is that critical mass whereby the next 10 schools that those schools can coach in the future, if they've achieved that emancipated learning mindset,
right,
if they're able to have a student first perspective, if they're able to bring inclusive and participatory learning as opposed to one-way learning, if they're able to draw from multimedia sources of learning and not just one form of curriculum, mm-hmm, if they're able to move the activities towards team-based, project-based, portfolio-based learning, if I'm able to show that leads to improved learning outcomes based on a PISA-like competency assessment, then that will have bought the security and right to continue that initiative to the rest of the national educational system, no matter who the president or who the minister is next. That will buy the right to keep this strategy moving forward, even when I'm no longer there?
Well, I know that on behalf of my organization, Edon Prize Foundation, everyone who's listening, and certainly everyone in Indonesia, we wish you every success in that extraordinary, well-articulated goal. And anything we can do to help, just, you know, very happy to pitch in. So thank you very, very much for an inspirational discussion, for being an inspirational leader, and go for it. We're all rooting for you.
Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conversations on Doing Good. Please follow our conversations wherever you get your podcasts or through the CAPS website at caps.org.